let's read through the psukim in Bamidbar Perek He, the fifth chapter of Bamidbar. I'm sure you've read through the psukim, but it always pays to read through them again. And does anybody know which parsha in the Torah we're learning now? For Sota. Anybody? It's not the first parsha in Sefer Bamidbar, it's the second one. Anybody know what that's called? Nasa. Okay, so keep that in mind, because you know people are gonna say you were in Rabbi Berzon's class and you don't know what parsha you were studying. Oh, so you gotta know parsha's Nasa, okay? So the Torah says in the fifth chapter of Bamidbar, by Daber Hashem el Moshe Lemor, Daber el Bnei Yisrael, Ish o Isha, ki asu mikol chatos ha'odom limol mal v'ashem. Okay, so that's the parsha of Me'ilah. And we're not going to study that parsha. We'll fast forward to Pasuk Yud Aleph. And it's interesting, maybe we'll get a chance to talk about the smichus ha'parshios, you know, the contiguity here between the parsha of Me'ilah and the parsha of Sota. And it says the following: Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe lemar, daber el bnei Yisrael, v'yamart aleihem, ish ish, ki tiste ishto, u'ma'ala bo mal. So I'm going to read the English translation. It says here, any man whose wife shall go astray, interesting, shall go astray, that's called ki tiste. So when we talk about Masechta Sota, we're talking about a woman who went astray, kitista. But the Torah gets even more specific here in describing the nature of her sin. And it says, umala bo ma'al. And again, the Art Scroll translation here is a little bit loose. He says, commit treachery against him. Again, treachery is a funny kind of word that could have many, many different meanings. I don't know what you associate in your mind with the word treachery. I can think of a thousand different possibilities. But what's most important is that the word is ma'al. Mem ayin lamed. So that's the word that we should be writing down on our... let's see if we have... No. No luck for that. But anyway, if we find a magic marker of some sort... I know the Israelis call it a lord. I don't know. Never figured out exactly.
Do you want to have a look in the office tomorrow?
No, we should just look around. Keep your eyes open, Johnny. Maybe you'll see it either behind me or...
It's a little red thing. What's that red thing there?
I'm not seeing it.
It's a pen.
No, just straight ahead here.
That's a label.
I mean, there is something here. Let's see if by chance in a million this works. Okay.
Make sure it's not let's permanent.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll try. Okay. So here's the word that you want to write down: ma'al. Okay? And this is the verb. Okay? Is ma'al. Now, if I want to change it into a noun, I add one letter at the end. What's that? A hey, and then it becomes me'ilah. Actually, I added two letters. I added a yud and a hey. Me'ilah. Okay? So that's the noun. Now, the reason why I emphasize this is because I asked you the following question. What is the connection between the first parsha and the second parsha? The first parsha says that Aber bnei Yisrael 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 ki asu mikol chatas adam limol mal v'ashem. Again, the same word mal, which means that he committed a treachery. But in this case, it's towards God. Now, here what we're talking about is you have something that belongs to Hegdesh. Okay? So everybody knows what Hegdesh is. Okay? You know, we're not going to talk about the Vatican. Okay? But there's such a thing called Hegdesh, which means that there's some sort of ownership over masses amount of possessions, and that's owned by the holy Hegdesh, you know, Hegdesh. And if a person misappropriates Hegdesh, that's called a Me'ilah. You know, he takes something that's Hegdesh and he uses it for his own purposes. So in a sense, he's stealing from God, because Hekdesh is this massive ownership over possessions by God, and God is represented by Hekdesh. Hekdesh means something that's sanctified. Okay, so when you sanctify something, like for example, if I own this chair and I declare it Hekdesh, now it's owned by Hekdesh. And the minute it's owned by Hekdesh, I'm not allowed to sit in the chair, because then I'm using Hekdesh, which I'm not allowed to do. That's called Me'ilah. So Me'ilah, in a sense, is stealing something from Hekdesh. Here, in the case of a married woman, I'm stealing something from who?
The husband.
The husband, exactly. And that's called Me'ilah. So you'll see here the Torah, when it describes the Sota, it says not only ki tista ishto, that she did this act of going astray, but it says umala bo ma'al. She has now, in a sense, taken away from him, so to speak, meaning she is misappropriating, in a sense, her loyalty or her being married to her husband. Right, so that's a kind of a me'ilah, where she's stealing from her husband. Okay, then?
It's the opposite of when he got married to her, where he mekadesh.
Right? Excellent.
It's like
excellent.
The reverse of that.
Yeah, because when he married her, he was magdish her to him, and now he has what's called a kinyan ishus. Again, we'll hopefully these words will be explained as we go along. But he has some sort of ownership rights over her, such that she cannot have a relationship with another man. And that's the way the Torah understands marriage. And if she does have this relationship, she is, in a sense, undermining his ownership, his kiddushin. And that's called me'ilah in the language of the Torah.
So she's not entitled to anything by the ketubah. She's gone against it. She's nullified the agreement.
Excellent point. She has to forfeit her rights to the ketubah, because those rights are rights within the kinyan ishus, within this relationship between him and her. But I wanted to point out something else. Umala bo ma'al. I'm going to ask you the following question. Okay, we have a concept in halacha. This is all an introduction, and believe me, in a few minutes we'll start the Gemara. But in halacha, we have a concept called shogeg. Can anybody tell me what shogeg is?
Unintentional.
Excellent. An unintentional violation.
It's really called negligence.
Negligence. Excellent. Because that's even sharper. Negligence. So now, this is not a violation that was deliberate. In other words, it wasn't that somebody wanted to rebel against the Almighty and he knowingly did so, but rather it is unintentional. Now, I'm going to ask you one question, and the answer to this question will depend upon knowing something which you may or may not know. So the question is, I'm debating back and forth, should I tell you what you should know, or should I just first ask you the question? Okay. What the heck? I'm just going to ask you the question, and then I'll tell you what you have to know, if you don't know it. What would you say about a woman, a married woman, who has a relationship with a man unintentionally? Now again, this may sound wild to you, but there are situations in which a man can approach a married woman and somehow convince her, you know, based on, he's going to tell a mystical tree, you know, he has Ruach HaKodesh, and he knows based on his knowledge of mysticism that they have to have this relationship.
Right, Bathsheba, Solomon and Bathsheba.
Yeah, I mean, by the way, what I'm telling you, as wild as it sounds, has happened over and over again throughout history. People take advantage of a woman, and they present themselves as, you know, holy of holies, you know, they're holy rollers, and just for the purpose of having this illicit relationship. She is somehow convinced that she, you know, she is doing the will of God and having this relationship.
Would you call that shogeg harav l'mezid? I mean, because she it's with her. You know, she's voluntarily doing that, and she should know better. I mean, you know, by all
Okay, but if he's a good con artist, maybe, you know, he can convince her. Again, I don't know. You know, it's kind of difficult. But I'll come back to your point in just a second. Okay, so here's my first question to you. And the answer to this depends on whether you know something else. In a case like I described to you, where she is, let's say, a shogeg, we'll use that as a generic term, because she's not deliberately violating the Torah law, and she's having this relationship with another man, thinking that the Torah would permit her to do so because he did such a great job pulling the wool over her heads. That's why you have to make sure that your wife is knowledgeable in Torah, you know, because otherwise, you know, things could happen, chas v'shalom. So what would be her status as a sota? Would she be a sota or would she not? Again, the case is a shogeg. She thought that the relationship that she was about to have, and she did have, was permissible within the halakhic boundaries. And she went ahead and she slept with another man. Is she a sota? Now, for example, the implication of a sota would be that she's never allowed to resume her relationship with her husband. You know that, right? That far you've gotten, so I don't know how far you got, but if you're ready up to Daf Beis Amid Beis, that's what they told me, you know Daf Beis Amid Aleph, that she can no longer resume her relationship.
It's a bit difficult, it's just explained. Okay.
I'm sorry, but you guys fight it out? You know?
Please. No, I was going to say, I suppose it depends whether she'd been warned.
She has to be warned to be a sota.
She needs to be a sota. She needs to be warned, doesn't she? So,
Good point.
Mm. What do you mean by warned? You're talking about kinui and stira?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Let's assume there was kinui and stira. Okay, whatever. But here I need an answer to a different question, which you may or may not know. What happens if this belongs to Hegdesh? I don't know it. Or maybe I knew it, but I forgot it. And then I went ahead and I used it, right? I sat in the chair. And the Torah says in such a case you have to bring, if it's Me'ilah, right, you have to bring a Korban Chatos, right? It's a Korban Asham, actually, to be more precise, but we're not learning Kachim, but he has to bring a Korban for that. Yes or no? Anybody know? The whole parsha of Me'ilah that is immediately before Sota here in Parshas Noso is all dedicated to a shogeg situation. That's exactly what happens. In fact, if you were Me'ilah b'mezid, then it's a more complicated situation. But basically, you're not chayav from Mishum Me'ilah. You don't have to bring the korban because the moment that you are mezid, then the status of Hegdesh is completely lost. It desecrates the Kedusha, and it's mechalel the Hegdesh, and therefore you're not chayav. So that if I were to tell you now that the Torah went out of its way to add three words in the parasha of Sota, Kitista Ishto, Umala Bomal, then what would be your impression? Why did the Torah have to add those three words, Umala Bomal? I could have easily have dropped those words without any loss to understanding the parasha. But if the Torah went out of its way to add these three words to connect it to the previous parasha, which is the parasha of Me'ilah in Kodshim, in Hefesh, and this parasha of Me'ilah applies in a case of what?
Shogeg.
Then what would you say about the case of a sota of the shogeg? Would she be allowed to reassume her relation with her husband?
No. You would have thought so, wouldn't you?
No.
Again, listen to the structure here, Jeremy. Forget about human logic. I'm asking you to be a mathematician here. Correct? Pure mathematics. You have two parashas in the Torah that are contiguous, one after the other. One is the parasha of Me'ilah in Kodshim, in Hegdesh, and the other is the parasha of Sota. In the parasha of Sota, the Torah went out of its way to add three words that would, at the face of it, be superfluous, namely Umala Bomal. And those words take us back to the previous parasha of Me'ilah in Hegdesh. Now I add another point, and here's where I want you to put on your mathematical thinking caps. In the case of Me'ilah in Hegdesh, the parasha is talking about a case of Shogeg. He had no intention to deliberately misappropriate Hegdesh for his own purposes. He simply wasn't aware of the fact that it was Hegdesh. He knew it was Hegdesh, but he forgot, or he thought he could use it for whatever purpose.
So therefore he doesn't bring a korban.
So again, he brings the korban. The whole parsha of korban is in the case of shogeg. Okay. Are you with me?
But here, there's no recognized katos. Therefore, if you're going
to here, where
with both places, both with the kochin and with the sota.
Again, in the case of kochin, listen carefully. The Torah says that if you misappropriate hegdish and you use it for your own purposes, bishogeg,
right,
then you bring a karma. That's what it says. You do bring a karma. The whole parsha of karma me'ila is addressing the case of shogeg. Now the Torah gets to sota and says, umalo bamalo. We're trying to rack our brains. Why did the Torah add those three words? What would be your mathematical conclusion if the Torah went out of its way to not only put the parasha of Sota immediately following the parasha of Me'ilah in Hegdish, but uses the same exact language again? What would be your conclusion, Jeremy?
An implication of Chatos.
You would say it's not a mitigating circumstance. So.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. And the one who said this, it's not my own original insight, was he was called the Maharik. Marik, okay, he was a gigantic posek 6 centuries ago, and he had this case of a woman who allowed herself with full intention to have an illicit relationship, an adulterous relationship with another man, because he convinced her that the Torah would allow it. What do you think the Marik paskin? Would she be allowed to go back to her husband or not?
No.
She would not be allowed to go back to husband. Why? Because the Torah says, Umala bo ma'al. What does the word bo mean?
Shogeg.
Bo means to him. To him, right? Ba is to her and bo is to him. Umala, she did a me'ilah, an act of embezzlement, if you will, against him. Who's the him over here? Okay. Is it the him with a capital H or the him with a small H?
Small H.
With a small H. Umala bo ma'al. The Torah is describing her undoing, so to speak, the relationship that she has with her husband. Umala bo ma'al. So the Marik concludes, therefore, that even though she's a shogeg as far as God is concerned, because she was absolutely convinced in her naivete that she was allowed to have this relationship, so she did not intend to violate the prohibition of Gilui Arayos, of Eishes Ish, of a married woman in adultery, but nevertheless, she was Umala Bo Ma'al, which means that she went out of the relationship and the loyalty and the designation that she has to her husband to have this relationship with another man. And therefore, according to the Marik, there's a very definite reason why the Torah has these two sections, one next to the other. Okay. Now, we ask ourselves the following question. How many witnesses do we need in order to establish this woman as a sota? Does anybody know, in general, as a universal rule in halacha, how many witnesses we require?
Two.
Two, correct. Al pishnayim edim yakum dover.
One.
The Torah says that you need how many witnesses? You need a minimum of two witnesses. Is there an exception here in the case of sota? So let's read. What do you say?
When the court's in the act.
Oh. So let's read the next pasuk. The pasuk says the following. V'shachav ish osa, another man sleeps with this woman, this married woman, shechva zera. We have to see what that phrase means. Okay, that's not for us now. V'nelam me'enei isha. And her husband is not sure about it. You know, he doesn't know, he has no proof. And then the Torah says, v'nistara v'hi nitma'a. Okay, so we have two concepts here that are very important. We have to write them on the board. One is called, in the verb nistara, in the noun it's called stira. So again, if you could, again, just to save me the hassle of having to write it on the board, if you could write down stira, samach, tav, yud, resh, hey, stira. And then you have nitma, which is tuma. The word tuma, which literally translates as defilement, means that she had the relationship. She actually had this adulterous relationship. Okay, then the Torah says, "V'ed ein ba." There was no witness. Not even one witness. It sounds like what would have been sufficient here? One witness. This is very strange. The Torah should have said the Eidim Ein Ba. There were no two witnesses, because the standard and the requirement of the Torah for testimony to provide evidence is always a minimum of two. Why does the Torah say the Eid Ein Ba? And then it says Vehilo Nitfasa, which means she wasn't raped. It wasn't against her will. She was a consulting adult. And then the Torah goes on to describe what's called Kinui. Okay, Kinui is the original process, the first stage in a woman becoming a sota. Kina means when he tells her that she's not allowed to be alone with a certain man. That's called Kinui. Then we have Stira. She went ahead and she violated his admonishment, his warning. She went ahead and she had Yichud, meaning she was alone with this man that he warned her not to be alone with. And then, Vehi Nitma. Now the Torah describes a case in which we don't know for sure what happened during that stira period. Did she have this relationship or did she not? And therefore the Torah requires her to drink what? Anybody remember what that's called?
The bitter waters.
The bitter waters, yeah, that's called Mayim Hamararim, the bitter waters. And supposedly what's going to happen here is that if she was guilty, as a result of this concoction that she drinks, her stomach is going to explode and she's going to die. So that's going to be human punishment for her violation of adultery if she was guilty and she did it deliberately. But there may be situations in which, at least as far as her relationship with her husband is concerned, we can clarify without her drinking the Mayim that she actually had this relationship. Now, if you would ask me how would we prove that she had this relationship before I saw this section in the Torah, I would have told you we need two witnesses who actually saw her having this relationship. But since the Torah says the Eid Ein Ba, it means that there's not even one witness, and in the absence of that one single witness, we have to have her drink the Mayim because we really don't know. Implying that if there would have been one witness, that would have been sufficient. So let's put the Chumash now on the side, and let's go back to the Mishnah itself, right? The Mishnah at the beginning of Masechtas Sota. Okay. So the Mishnah records the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer. Okay, according to Rabbi Eliezer, Kinui requires two witnesses. Stira only requires one witness. That's the way our Mishnah records the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer. And then the Mishnah records another opinion, and that's the opinion of Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yoshua holds that both Kinui and Stira require two witnesses. So how do you go about doing this? Do you write notes? Do you want me to summarize this on the board? What is your general approach? You know, I don't know what you're used to and what you're not used to.
What normally happens is Rabbi Myers gives us the words. We write the diary.
Okay. So if that's what you want to do, let's do it the following. Turn to Daf Beis Amud Beis. Now, if you take a look on Daf Beis Amud Beis, you will see approximately 15 lines down from the top, two dots. Are you able to find that?
Rabbi Yoshua?
Yeah, it should begin with Rabbi Yoshua. The last word in the line is Rebbe. The first word in that line is Ubitray. Yes, we have it? Okay. So let's see, how many lines? About 15? Does that make sense?
Yoshua is the first word on the line.
Now, what the Gemara does is it reprints the Mishnah itself, in this case, Rabbi Yoshua. So let's read the Mishnah, but we don't have to turn back to Daf Beis Amud Aleph because the Gemara actually reprints the Mishnah of Rabbi Yoshua here. And Rabbi Yeshua Omer, Rabbi Yeshua is of the opinion that Mekane lo al pishnaim. So we're going to have to translate those words. The word Mekane is the verb of the word Kinui. Kinui is the noun. Kinui is what? Who remembers what Kinui is?
Warning.
Correct. Kinui is the warning when he tells her that she's not allowed to be alone with this man. And he specifies a particular man. And Rabbi Yeshua says, Al Pishnayim, that in order for the entire section or the laws of Sota to apply, where she has to drink these Mayim of Marorim that we spoke about, those bitter waters, you need that two witnesses testify that she had the Kinui. Now you see it next, it says V'chule. Do you see V'chule? V'chule means etc., because the Gemara doesn't quote the entire Mishnah. The Mishnah in Rabbi Yeshua goes on to say that stira means if she actually goes into yichud, she's alone with this man, she violates the warning, that also requires the testimony of two witnesses.
Rabbi, I can ask a question. If he gives a warning against a particular man,
yes,
and she then has an adulterous affair with another man,
so it depends. If there are witnesses that can testify that she had that adulterous relationship, then she will be put to death. But we're talking about a case where we don't know. We don't have any objective testimony as to whether or not she had that relationship. So in such a case, every woman is guiltless until proven... She's innocent until proven guilty.
No, but it's specific.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Well, she wouldn't necessarily be a soldier then, would she?
Because she would not be a soldier.
Because he only gave a warning against...
Right, and therefore, that's what I say. Sota is, in a sense, guilty until proven innocent. Any other woman is innocent until proven guilty. What do I mean?
But if somebody... She's only guilty in respect to the man that was warned, right?
I mean, again, that's a sota. But let me talk about Jeremy's case. Jeremy's case is there was no kinui, there was no stira, but we suspect her of having a relationship with somebody. No, somebody from the world. In such a case, she's innocent until proven guilty. Meaning, unless there were two witnesses who could testify, they were there, and they gave her a warning, whatever it might be, she is considered to be innocent. Now we get to the case of sota. What's unique about sota, as Iris said before, where he, the husband, specifies one particular man and warns her not to be secluded with that man. That's called kinui. And then she went ahead and she had a stira, which means that she had a secluding, what's called yichud, right? Yichud means a seclusion with that very man that he warned her against. At that point, she becomes a sota. Once she becomes a sota, then basically she's guilty until proven innocent. And the only way she can prove her innocence is when she drinks from these mei marorim and she survives it. Until that point, we assume that because she violated the kinui and she went alone with this man, that she had a relationship with this man. You know, it's very interesting. To what extent does the Torah see her as guilty until she drinks to the main moron? To the extent to which she's not allowed to live with her husband. Are you with me, Rabbi Osai? Today, in the year, what are we up to, 2020? Right? Tough phrase, pay. If today, I'm telling you right now, if a man would give kinui to his wife, and he would, you know, do it in the formal way, let's say, according to Rabbi Yeshua, in front of two witnesses, and then she would have stira, she would go into a secluded place with that man, two witnesses testify that she was secluded, they don't know what happened in the seclusion, she would not be allowed to live with her husband. Because we don't have the mei marorim. And she's guilty until proven innocent. So kinui and stira are far-reaching implications even today. Even today. This is not a, you know, Beis HaMikdash kind of mitzvah. You know, we need the Beis HaMikdash.
She wouldn't be allowed on Shuma either. She's a Kohen, married to a Kohen.
Ah, okay. So that I'm not sure about. Yeah. Would she be allowed to eat truma? You mean to say she was originally married to a Kohen or now she marries a Kohen?
No, originally she's married to a Kohen.
Oh, okay.
Now,
okay, I thought you meant if she would now marry a Kohen. Oh, okay. So again, I'm not sure I can focus on truma. You know, John, you're a few steps ahead of me, but you're right. Truma would be a very interesting case. But I think what's more, you know, far-reaching is whether or not she could resume her marriage relationship. And the answer is that right now, she had kinui and stira. We assume that she's guilty. until she drinks from the Mei Morarim, and that we don't have today. So we don't have the Mei Morarim today, and therefore she's guilty until proven innocent, and we can't prove her innocent. Now, what does it take to have kinui and stir? So, according to Rabbi Yeshua, you need two witnesses on the kinui, and you need two witnesses on the stira. Correct? That is the opinion of Rabbi Yeshua. Who disagrees with Rabbi Yeshua?
Eliezer.
Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer is of the opinion that kinui requires two witnesses, but stira, all you need is one witness.
Even himself.
And possibly even himself. Correct. We'll get to himself as well. But right now, let's focus on the witnesses. So again, it's very amazing when we saw in the parsha that all you need is one witness. The Torah was not necessarily talking about stira. It says she doesn't have one witness, meaning that one witness would be sufficient. But that pasuk is referring to tumah. Tumah, we said, was if she had that relationship. So that, you know, Rabbi Eliezer is making a real jump over here. He's taking a pasuk out of context. The pasuk, the verse itself, is talking about X, and he applies it to Y. And the Torah says all you need is one witness. Right? Because the Torah says there is no one witness. Applying had there been one witness, then that would be it. End of story. Well, what are we talking about? The Torah explicitly is talking about one witness on the tumah. Right, so you have kinui, stira, and then tumah. Right, kinui means don't go into the room with him. Stira means she went ahead and had a seclusion with that man. And then tumah means that she actually had that relationship when she was alone with him in that closed, secluded area. And how many witnesses do we need to establish that she had that relationship? All we need is one. Now Rabbi Eliezer takes it a step further. Not only does the Torah recognize the validity of one single witness as far as tumah is concerned, but even as far as stira is concerned, one witness is enough. So again, if I were to ask you to line up the opinions with regard to kinui, how many witnesses do we require in kinui? How many different opinions would you line up in this controversy? Only one. There is no controversy. I fooled you. Okay, just to test. As far as kinui is concerned, there's no machlokas, there's no controversy. Everyone, even Rabbi Eliezer, agrees you need a minimum of two witnesses. That's as far as kinui is concerned. Now, kinui sets the whole process into motion, right? The whole framework is predicated on kinui. And that, in order to set off the whole process, you need two witnesses. The machlokas, the controversy now between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer revolves around what? Not kinui, but stira. Again, I'm assuming you're writing down kinui and stira, because if you're not, I'll have to do it on the board. Should I do it on the board?
No, it's all right. No,
it's okay. You're good. Kinui and then stira. So again, as far as kinui is concerned, everybody agrees you need how many witnesses?
Two
witnesses. As far as stira is concerned, Rabbi Yeshua says you need what? Two witnesses. As Rabbi Eliezer says, all you need is what? One witness. If we have that, then we're ready to go, you know.
And two more?
And two more, everybody agrees all you need is one witness. Right? Because there the Torah says, V'hi nitmeis v'ein einba. There's not even one witness, implying that one witness would be sufficient. Rabbi Eliezer went one step further, and he applied that yardstick of one witness in Tumah to the case of stira. Rabbi Yeshua rejected that, and he said that no. When the Torah says one witness is reliable, that's only as far as Tumah is concerned, but not as far as stira is concerned. Therefore, according to Rabbi Yeshua, out of this three-stage process, the first and second stage is required two witnesses. That's Rabbi Yeshua's opinion. Comes along Rabbi Eliezer, he says, no, the second stage is like the third stage. The second stage, which is called stira, has the same requirements as the third stage, which is tumah, and all you need is what? One witness.
Isn't it very unexpected, impractical to think that there would ever be an aid for tumah?
Well, actually, the classic case in which the Torah is the whole parsha of the Torah, where you put a woman to death, is where there are two witnesses, I mean, who actually see the crime. I mean, again, if she was smart, you know, she would have made sure that there was no witnesses around. You know,
well, but that's very rare. That's why Rabbi Akiva, and you know, says once in 70 years or something.
Yeah, I think, right. If I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Akiva was referring to something slightly different.
No,
Rabbi Akiva, when he said once in 70 years, he was talking...
The boy who was a wayward boy, what do you call it, 13 year old?
Oh, the Ben Sora Motor?
Yeah.
Ah, that's a different song. Oh, that's in Sanhedrin.
Sorry.
The Mishnah that I was referring to is in Masechta Makkos. And the last Mishnah in Masechta Makkos on Daf Zayin says that Rabbi Akiva said if you found a bezdin that put someone to death once in every 70 years, it would be a katlanis. That's a bloodthirsty killer bezdin.
That's because it's very rare to have somebody with two witnesses saying, you know, I'm going to do it anyways, go ahead, kill me. I mean, like, you know.
But basically, I think what Rabbi Akiva is talking about there is the process of judgment, meaning when you have 23 judges sitting on a court, then inevitably what's going to happen is that each judge has a different opinion. You know, he sees something in a different way. So he'll weigh the evidence and he'll come to some sort of, you know, mitigating, you know, justifying thing that the person is not guilty as accused, maybe as Iris said, because would there be two witnesses and would he be mater atzmo l'misa and all the different conditions that have to be met. But I think Rabbi Akiva's comment is on the nature of the judicial process. What we mean is the debates that go on between all the rabbis. In fact, the Mishnah says in Sanhedrin that if all 23 judges unanimously want to condemn the person, then he gets exonerated. I mean, there are so many different halachas that apply to how, for example, we're not going to let a person who commands respect to be the first one to open up the deliberations in the court, because then the other 22 judges will be so influenced by what this person, let's say he was the Nasi, he's the giant of the court. Okay, let's not get too far off on a tangent. So again, so now we want to understand my timer de Rabbi Yoshua. Everybody have the place? Yeah. You have your finger on the place? How does Rabbi Myers know that everyone in the class has his finger on the place? He assumes so?
He repeats again where we are.
Yeah, well, that's hard for me to do. I don't know. It's I don't have any numbers, line numbers.
Okay, seven lines from the bottom.
Seven lines up from the beginning of the narrow lines. Okay, good. If that helps you. Okay. So again, if you have a Gemara that you could underline, you want to use my pencil here and then erase it later, it's up to you. Or, oh, that's your, sorry, Yaakov, I didn't mean to steal your pencil. So you underline the words, my taima de Rabbi Yoshua. Right? What is the tam, you know, the logic that underlies Rabbi Yoshua? In other words, why is Rabbi Yoshua absolutely convinced that you always require two witnesses? In other words, whether it's two witnesses for the kinui or two witnesses for the stira. Why does he require two witnesses? And now, I'll be honest with you. When I read this Gemara, I got up a little early this morning and I read this Gemara and I was absolutely perplexed. I mean, I wouldn't have asked the question, my time to Rabbi Yoshua. I would have asked the question, my time to Rabbi Eliezer.
For one.
Yeah, because Rabbi Eliezer is violating the universal rule in Eidus that the Torah says, Al Pishnayim Eidim Yokum Dov, the Torah requires two witnesses. It doesn't seem to me that the ball is in Rabbi Yoshua's court, that the burden of proof is in his court, and he should sweat it out and try to justify why he requires two witnesses. On the contrary, I would ask Rabbi Eliezer, why does he lower the requirement of two witnesses?
But we know the pasuk in Bava, so therefore, why is he saying he still needs two?
So it could be that what the Gemara means is that somehow, again, I still don't understand yet why or how, the Gemara thinks that the Ein Eid Bar should somehow refer to the stira. It's not. Yeah. This, what I'm telling you is absolutely wrong. The Ein Eid Bar doesn't refer to stira. Ein Eid Bar refers to what, everybody?
Tumah.
So again, I'm a little perplexed here as to why the Gemara is trying to justify Rabbi Yeshua. I wouldn't have sweated out over here as to why there's any problem here with Rabbi Yeshua. You know what? I just want to take a stab at it. I think maybe what the Gemara means to say is the following: that Are you interested in hearing my pontifications? Yeah. I don't know. It's up to you. I get it.
That's why we're here, right?
Has a different style. So
it's a good question.
Yeah, I think what the Gemara believes here is that stira is the beginning of tuma. Let me try to explain what I mean. The process of sota, I'm not talking about testing the sota with by her drinking the waters, but I mean to say her guilt, which is divided up into three, can really be broken down into two instead of three. Let me explain. Naturally, if I would test you in a quiz and ask you how many different stages there are in the process of her guilt, I would say kidui, stira, and tuma. Those are three different processes. Okay, but you could argue that really it's only two. What do I mean? Because as far as Sota is concerned, as we said at the outset, she is guilty until proven innocent. And if that be the case, then the very moment that... In other words, when is the presumption, or what generates the presumption of guilt? If we assume that Sota, like for example today, that we don't have the ability for her to prove herself innocent because we don't have Mei Merarim, so therefore she's guilty, what actually generates her guilt? Now you might say Tumah, because she had this relationship. Well, that's right, and I can't reject that. But what generates our assumption of guilt?
Stira, her violation.
Stira, exactly, a violation of...
She's warned, and then she violates the warning.
Exactly. Once the kinui has taken place, from now on, if she doesn't take that kinui seriously, she is now involved in a guilt process. In other words, you ask me, well, the Torah never considers someone guilty, even if they're serious, you know. Well, we have a phrase in English, you know, maybe it's a British phrase, I don't know, where there's smoke, there's fire, right? Yeah. But the Torah doesn't operate with that. Uh-huh. There is one sugya.
It's also innocent until proven guilty.
Correct, you're innocent until proven guilty, even if there's smoke. What do I mean, even if there's smoke?
Fire.
Right. What is this? This is a sugya in the Sefer Ksuvos. Again, we're not learning Ksuvos, but you should know there's a sugya in Ksuvos called Laz, Lamed Ayin Zayin, which means that there's a bad rumor going around about a woman that she's living a loose relationship. So the Gemara wants to know whether Kohen is allowed to marry such a woman, because a Kohen's not allowed to marry a woman who had a relationship with a non-Jewish man. Anyway, to make life simple, that sugya is the exception to the rule rather than the rule. Even though the Gemara does assume for kahuna, in certain cases we're worried about laws, you know, there's a bad rumor, you know, with the smoke there's fire, but as a general rule there's no such thing. So now I ask you the following question: what is this woman guilty of that all of a sudden, with the smoke there's fire, all of a sudden we're casting upon her an assumption on our part that she actually had this adulterous relationship? And the only answer I could come up with in terms of active, I'm not talking about circumstantial evidence, but what did she do actively to bring upon herself this status of guilt? It's the stira. And here's where the Gemara objects to Rabbi Yoshua, and the Gemara needs a special justification for Rabbi Yoshua. And the lack of that justification, the Gemara is perplexed. How does Rabbi Yoshua say that stira is different than tuma? In a sense, stira and tuma are really two halves of a whole. They're two parts of one entity. They're not two different stages. It's an action where she already brought upon herself an assumption of guilt. And what is that action? That's stira. If the Torah says explicitly v'eid einbar that you only need one witness to establish her guilt, then maybe we should establish her guilt already at the point of stira with one witness. And that's what I think is, again, in my own, it's just my own pontification, but that's, I think, underlies the Gemara's question, my time with Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua is not logical. Why isn't he logical? You'll ask me, but the Torah always requires two witnesses. What's illogical about Rabbi Yeshua? The answer is that once the Torah has said that guilt is established with one witness, that's called Eid Tumah, and all the Torah needs is Ein but one witness, then her guilt is already established. We preempted Tumah. Even before we get to the stage of Tumah, the Gemara thinks that Rabbi Eliezer is very logical, and already at the point of what? At the point of Stira, we should already trust one witness, because she did that terrible act of stira, and that already generates an assumption of guilt.
In those days, wasn't it a protected society?
you like Dina, right. To Dina. I mean, you know, father warned her not right. to go.
It also fits in very well with my question. How do you ever expect an aide to see the actual act? And it's highly unlikely. So if you go by your premise, then
maybe one witness is more likely.
Okay. Just for the seclusion.
Right. But again, I was trying to avoid the, you know, all the...
The blood.
Yeah, no, what I mean is there's something in the world of yeshivas which is called mitzias. Mitzias means the reality. I'm trying to avoid the reality. I'm trying to climb up to, in a sense, the theoretical conceptual world. So, again, you're not used to my style. So, you know, you're always going to hit me with the reality. I'm always going to try to avoid reality because I think when you get to reality... Yeah. The whole shas goes upside down, inside out. But again, I don't expect you, you know, to...
Yeah, it's not whether it could happen or is likely to happen. It's understanding the laws
right.
of how it
you want to write a treatise, you want to write a PhD thesis on whether it's likely or unlikely, bavakasha. You know, you'll get a bracha, I'll write you a letter of approbation if you need my letter. I want to know conceptually, what is the Gemara bothered by? And I'm suggesting that conceptually, the Gemara is committed to the following abstract idea. This is totally abstract, has nothing to do with reality. And that is, what action did she perform that is a guilty action that generates an assumption of guilt? You follow what I'm saying? She violated something. There was something bad that she did. And as a result of that bad act, the Torah says to her, you know what? You're not a pure soul anymore. You've already tainted your reputation, your status.
Incredible.
And the Torah says that stira is the beginning of tumah. Do you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's really the beginning of tumah, even though, again, we still haven't clarified that she had this relationship, but no, the Torah already assumes that something's going on over here. That's called stira. And if the standards for tumah are lowered, you know, the Torah is very, very strict about that. And the Torah says, you know, all you need is one witness. You know, that's very rare that the Torah would say that one witness is enough to bust up a marriage. Then that should apply to stira as well, because already at the point of stira, she has brought upon herself such a level of guilt that she's already in the tumah realm. You know, following saying she's in the expanded circle of tumah. You know, we see kinui as the greatest circle, and then stira as the smallest circle, and then tumah as the smallest circle. But what we're doing is now we're expanding the circle of tumah, and we're widening it to include stira as well, because stira is the point of no return, the point after which she would have to establish beyond the shadow of a doubt her innocence. Okay, Amar Kro. So let's see what the Gemara could come up with to explain Rabbi Yehoshua. Amar Kro. The Torah says ba. Okay, so let's go back to the Torah itself. The Torah says v'ein ein ba. The Gemara makes the following assumption, that you can omit the word ba without any loss to the meaning of the verse. The word ba is therefore superfluous. Now, whenever we have a superfluous word, we apply a principle called miut. Now again, you'll have to write this down because it's a technical term. I'll tell you, it's in English, they call it an exclusion, but you know... You guys are future giants in Torah, so if you use the word exclusion, you know, they're going to laugh you out of the yeshivas. So I want you to get entry into the best yeshivas here in Israel. So if you come to the Rosh Yeshiva and you say to him exclusion, he's going to throw you into art scroll. You know, you say, go learn yeshiva of art scroll. But if you want to get into a real yeshiva, he's going to say to you a mute. A mute means that when the Torah adds a word, it's coming to limit it and saying only in that case. Otherwise, the Torah didn't have to add that word. So again, logically, we would have said, v'ein eid, there's no witness. If there would have been a witness, and at what point would that witness be sufficient? The moment that she does something out of hand, that she's guilty of violating his warning, namely at the point of stira. Well, why then did the Torah add the word ba? It could have just as easily have said, v'ein ein. Why did the Torah say ba? Ba means only in this particular, you know, plotted area. You know, we're gonna limit it to this area. The area that we're talking about is nitma'ah, right? The previous word is v'nitma'ah, meaning the word is tumah. And then it says v'ein ein ba. Ba is referring to tumah. There's no witness for tumah. If there would have been one witness for tumah, then the whole parasha of Sotah would be completely undermined. You know, blow it out of the water. But the ba comes to exclude Sotah. I'm sorry, nistara. Now, we also have to talk about kinui. Now, this is fascinating. We said over and over again, how many opinions do we have as far as the requirement of Vedas for kinui?
Two.
Only one. Again, I'm going to keep fooling you and don't fall into my trap. There's only one opinion, it's universally accepted, that kinui requires two witnesses. Right? Even Rabbi Eliezer agrees that kinui requires two witnesses. Is there what we call a hava mina, meaning is there a possibility logically to say that even kinui would require no more than one witness? And that's what we're going to try to prove to you from this line in the Gemara. The Gemara says, Amakra ba, ba velo bekinui. That when does the Torah say that we're going to be so careful and so strict that one witness is sufficient? That's only ba in the case of tumah, but not in the case of kinui. Now notice, nobody debated. There was never an opinion, never even a hava mina, until I got to this line of the Gemara, that kinui would be sufficient with one witness. Why would the Gemara even go down that pathway, that I need the pasuk ba to establish that kinui means two witnesses? There was a hava mina that kinui would require no less than one witness. We never discussed that kinui, you know, is different than any other form or mode in testimony, which the mode in testimony always requires how many witnesses? Two witnesses. But here, the Gemara is raising a mind-boggling havamin, as I call it, that if not for the word ba, then kinui would have required no more than what? One single witness. Again, please don't forget, everybody agrees, both Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer, they don't debate this, that kinui requires how many witnesses?
Two.
Two witnesses. But the Gemara is deriving that conclusion from an extra word in the Torah. Obviously, if not for that extra word, there would have been a havamina that kinui only requires one witness. And once again, you know, Berzon is banging his head against the wall. What was the havamina that kinui should be different? We worked very hard. We sweated out that maybe Stira is part of the process. It kicks off the process of tumah. And she's already guilty at that point because she went in secluding with that guy. But kinui, I mean, you know, he's jealous because he thinks that she has too much of a friendship relationship with so on. You know, imagine your wife works, right? I just give you a wild case, right? Your wife works. Today, by the way, even in the most religious circles, women, married women, are working. You can go to company after company and see women who are wearing shaytlach and they're working. These are Haredi women. And by the way, you should know that sociologically, this is a total revolution. And the Haredi world is suffering from it. There are all sorts of problems here. But again, I'm not here to critique. I'm just telling you the reality. You know, you like reality? This is the reality. It's wild. I mean, I can tell you what's going on in my own family. I mean, I have three daughters, all of whom are working. Now, once you enter into the work market, there's no such thing as, oh, I'm not going to talk to other men. You know, you can't, let's not fool ourselves. You're working in an office, whether it's your boss, whether it's this or that. I had a girl in my class in Michala, and we were learning the laws of Yichud in that class, in an institution called Michala. We were learning the Isser of not being secluded with a man. And a year later, after she left my class, she calls me up from Florida to ask me the following shot. She works in an office and she works overtime. They pay her 50% extra for overtime, and she's alone with the employer, with her boss. And I told her that there are certain conditions that have to be met here in order to allow such a thing. I wanted to make as much money as you can, but you got to do it legally. So today we live in such a world. So imagine, you know, again, I'm not, when I say your wife, I'm not addressing any individual, but imagine your wife works in an office, And, you know, she's friendly with the boss, you know, or anybody else in the office. A man, not a woman, right? I don't mind, you know, let her talk to all the women she wants to, right? And she hasn't done anything to make her guilty. You know, she's doing what she has to do. But I get jealous, right? So that's called kinu, milashon jealousy. So he gets jealous. Why is she having so much of a social intercourse with such a person? Who knows what that's going to lead to, right? But she hasn't done anything terrible. So why does the Gemara think that kinu itself would require nothing more than one witness, meaning that kinui itself should be placed into the guilt dimension of stage number two or stage number three? In other words, the Torah says if we're dealing with a woman who's guilty of something, then maybe one witness is enough to tip the scale and assume that she's already guilty. But in the case of kinui, she hasn't done anything. I mean, we don't know that she's guilty of anything whatsoever. She's just having some sort of a relationship with other men, and then all of a sudden the man says, her husband says, don't you dare, but he has to say that, and all we need is one witness. But again, we're setting into motion the whole process of something. We should require two witnesses.
Well, maybe,
I'm sorry,
maybe
I don't know.
There's going to be two one witness things. Kina would be one witness, and then Stira would have to also be one witness. Otherwise, I mean, there has to be somebody who sees them. Otherwise,
Empathize with me. What I need empathy on is as follows: if you want to tell me that Stira the Torah is very machmir, it's the exception to the rule, the universal rule is al pishnayim eidim, we need two witnesses. Stira, she was guilty. We already have a presumption of guilt. I can understand, but kinui. Why should she have a presumption of guilt? What did she do? She spoke to a man, and her husband said,
You had one witness twice. One witness that he warned her and not to be with a man, and one witness that says that she was with a man. So
you want to integrate the two witnesses and make them into one.
In order to get the whole process started, maybe it's...
That's a brilliant idea. I mean, I never thought in those terms.
So that's the end of the process.
Yeah, John, you hear what I was saying. I mean,
it doesn't go forward.
Be careful. If you don't respect him, he'll put you to sleep.
Not anymore.
You're officially this.
Okay. I get to sleep anyway.
but this is a deep sleep. You understand? You know the joke. Okay, anyway, so there are different levels of sleep, but what I'm saying is the following. So Ira is suggesting that maybe what the Gemara thinks here, it's a brilliant idea. Technically, I think it's not going to fit. I'll tell you why, because the Gemara has two psukim, one for Kini and one for Stir. But Ira is right that maybe what the Gemara is playing with is the idea that we take the one witness that testified on the Kinui and we integrate him with the one witness who testified on the Stira, and then in the entire process, looking at his one long entity, we have two witnesses. Excellent. I think it has a lot of meaning. I just don't know if I can get away with it, because take a look at the Gemara. The Gemara has two separate Havaminas with two separate drashos. The Gemara has a Havamina to say, ba v'lo b'kinui, meaning that you need two witnesses for kinui, and then the Gemara has another drasha that says ba v'lo b'stira. Maybe Ira, you would say the following: that we need two drashas in order to separate the two and make them independent testimonies, and therefore each testimony requires two witnesses. Maybe, I don't know.
They still do. You consider them guilty before they got to the stage of being caught in the stira. So.
I didn't catch what you said. There was an assumption of guilt, you said, or not an assumption of guilt?
Well, if we say that there can only needs to be one witness.
Right, it sounds like there's an assumption of guilt.
There's an assumption of guilt.
But again, what's the assumption of guilt? The man says to his wife, I don't want you to be alone with so-and-so. Why do we have any assumption of guilt?
We were saying that maybe because the two witnesses are put together for the two different stages, but it might not get to the second stage. It might not get caught in seclusion. They're still considered guilty, so that doesn't quite fit. But maybe it's because it only has an effect. All it is they're being brought forward as a sultan, so that finds out whether they're actually guilty or not. So it's only you're having the witnesses, whether it's one or whether it's two, to find out whether they are actually guilty. You want them to be innocent. You want them to drink the waters and they'll be blessed instead of
okay, that's interesting. But the blessing, yeah. But again, let's leave out the blessing. Because as I told you today, you know, the implication of what we're learning is that this woman could never resume a relationship with her husband. So imagine, he said to her in front of one person, "Don't go into this place with him." And then she went in front of one person, and he can never live with this woman again. So I mean, that's tragic.
Even if she's innocent, if she's brought forth as a soul search, she's innocent, she still can't be with her husband.
Right, we can't prove her innocence because we don't have the Beis HaMikdash today. So therefore, he's going to have to divorce his wife because one witness saw her, one witness was there when the husband warned her, and another witness was there when she went in.
So, going back...
Wow, that's really...
But going back to the blessing, if she is blessed with a child, then that's only she's not being warned.
Yeah. All right.
Well,
we'll call it... Should we call it a day at this point?
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't do that much in the Gemara, but I think we're putting things into perspective. So if you'll be back if you're a glutton for punishment, maybe tomorrow we'll make some more progress. Yeah, Rabbi Meir said he'll be back on Friday, so I assume class he'll give us on Sunday. I'll fill in until Thursday, unless you want to.
Yeah, great.
You can always veto it.
Do you want this?
Oh, okay. We'll keep it here, but I want you to know where it is.
Oh, I have the right edition. There must be two.
So make sure you put it in a place that you'll have access.
You said it was number. This is number two.
Sanhedrin? Is that Sanhedrin or Sota?
So,
no, that's the right one. No, that's not good.
That was on here. There must be two books for... The other is Sota 1. I thought, where do you get Sota 1 from to print that?
I gave it to you. I put it on the table.
That was Sota 2.
No, this is not the one I put on the table. I wanted to give you, Yaakov, I put right here on the table. I don't know who stole it.
If there's two witnesses for warning, is she brought as a Sota, or only if he then gets caught in seclusion?
Right, only if there's seclusion. Right. Now, how many people have to testify in the seclusion? That's going to be a controversy between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Yeshua says, I need another two witnesses on the seclusion when she violates the stira. And Rabbi Yeshua says, Rabbi Eliezer says, no, all I need is one witness on the seclusion, on the stira. But on the original kinui, even Rabbi Eliezer agrees that we need two witnesses.
Yeah. How does it work if she's innocent and she drinks and she's blessed with a child? How does that work with being with her husband? Is that
only then she goes back to her husband after she establishes her innocence? Then she resumes her married relationship.
Ah, so it's only up until that point, and that's.
But she'd be well advised not to do this again. You know what I'm saying? She's really playing with fire. Literally, I'm playing with fire.
Yeah.
You know, one time you can get a miracle, I wouldn't rely on another miracle. You know,
so. Yeah. That'd be a very traumatic ordeal.
Very traumatic. If you're innocent,
yeah,
that part is so cool. But I'm going to leave that for my mind.
There's still some level of guilt that, not that you did the act, but you've been secluded with another man.
She doesn't want to go that way. Don't go down that road again. You know, she survived it once. Okay, then? All right, have a great day.